From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and don't worry, we will get to the Best Picture fiasco in a bit, which I still can't believe. But first, to news from the White House today. President Trump wants a budget that will increase military spending and cut domestic spending.
This budget will be a public safety and national security budget, very much based on those two, with plenty of other things, but very strong. And it will include a historic increase in defense spending to rebuild the depleted military of the United States of America at a time we most need it.
Joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Jeremy.
And the number that's being thrown around is $54 billion for an increase in defense spending. How does the Trump administration say they plan to pay for that?
You know, they say they're going to do more with less, Jeremy, but that's pretty much just a start. We've been hearing about waste, fraud, and abuse from every president for as long as I can remember. There will be talk of offsets. You will hear the phrase pay-fors with a little hyphen in the middle of it. It boils down to cuts made elsewhere in the federal budget, but where? The Budget Control Act of 2011, that was passed while the current Republican majority was in place in the House, sets caps on defense and domestic spending. And if you lift one, you lift the other. That would release a lot of pent-up spending on both sides. And it would necessitate blowing by an actual law if you're going to ignore that. But we're in new territory now, and the enforcement is pretty vague on that particular law. So that may be just what they have in mind. Blow right by it, put it on the deficit.
But one place where we're not in new territory is that the president doesn't get to decide this exactly. He's got to get it through Congress, and they'll probably want to make changes to whatever budget he submits.
Yes, Congress cares about the deficit, even if the president doesn't. The Republicans in both chambers, the Republicans in the House and the Senate, actually believe that the national debt should be reduced and not raised. So that is going to be a clash point, and we're going to see it many, many times. But you know, the president has the bully pulpit, and he is going to use it tomorrow night to talk to the House and Senate, to lecture the House and Senate, to tell them, look, I represent what the people want, and so you guys have got to get busy and enact my priorities, and I don't want to hear a lot of talk about how it takes a long time to get things done on Capitol Hill.
Ron, this morning Trump also talked about health care and the ongoing process to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Let's listen.
We have come up with a solution that's really, really, I think, very good. Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated.
Nobody knew that healthcare could be so complicated. I think that maybe the Democrats would disagree with that, that they, when they put this all together, they knew how complicated it was. But do we know any more about this proposal, or just that Trump says it's really, really good?
You know, I think anyone who has been to a hospital or had any kind of dealings with the medical profession knows that healthcare can be rather complicated. And the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, is a highly complicated piece of legislation. And if you want to keep parts of it and not just repeal it root and branch, as people used to say, it's going to be a complicated process to make sure that you separate baby and bathwater. Now, there does seem to be something coming together in the last couple of weeks between the White House people and the Hill leaders. And we're being told, at least, that it preserves the most popular elements, things like the protection for people with pre-existing conditions so they can still get health care insurance. But we are also hearing from the Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan scoring agency, that this solution may not preserve those popular elements in quite the same form that we have them with the ACA, and also that, if anything, the plan being scored is going to cost more money and possibly add to the deficit or both.
And we'll have to wait and see because, again, we haven't seen a plan yet exactly about what is going to happen with the Affordable Care Act. One more thing, Ron. The state of the Democratic Party, we've got a new chair of the DNC, Tom Perez, who beat out Keith Ellison, the representative from Minnesota. What does that say to you about the direction of the Democratic Party?
It may well say less than it may seem to say. This was a close election, but the divisiveness between the top two candidates was mostly a holdover from the divisiveness of last year's Democratic primaries. The two men seem to have gotten along pretty well at the actual DNC meeting, Keith Ellison being the runner-up. They immediately appeared together. Tom Perez said, I'd like to have Keith be my vice chairman. He made that motion. It was unanimously approved. The two of them talked together about what the party needs to do going forward. So, you know, what's going to happen in 2018 probably has a lot less to do with who's chairman of the Democratic National Committee than it has to do with where the economy is going, how some of Trump's plans have gone at this point, and what his approval rating is at that point.
And the big news of today, perhaps, is that we still haven't gotten a tweet from Donald Trump about the Oscar fiasco last night. So we'll have to stand by and wait and see if he has anything to say about that. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, as Jeremy and Ron mentioned, the president is seeking a big increase in military spending. And Donald Trump has also promised to crush the so-called Islamic State and quickly. And the Pentagon plan Trump requested to try to do that is now on his desk. On the ground, U.S.-backed Iraqi military forces pushed deeper into ISIS-controlled Mosul today. Supported by American airstrikes and some U.S. troops, the Iraqis are trying to retake western Mosul after securing the eastern side weeks ago. NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman joins us now to talk about the Pentagon's ISIS strategy. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Eric.
So the president has talked about striking this quick and devastating blow, Tom, to ISIS. Does the new plan mark a significant change in U.S. strategy?
Well, first of all, I think the plan, you'll see an increase in American troops on the ground in both Iraq and Syria. Some of those troops will likely be closer to the front lines. But whether it provides a quick and devastating blow to ISIS, probably not. It's going to take some time, maybe months, to corral the Islamic State. So, but this will be, you know, quite a few more troops from what I'm hearing.
And the president, Tom, has campaigned on reducing U.S. commitments overseas. America first is his mantra. But this might be an expanded military role against ISIS and other terrorist groups. How do you square that?
Oh, I can't square it. I mean, the president's been kind of bipolar in this, America first on the one side, reducing commitments overseas. What I'm hearing is they could send as many as 500 American troops to Syria. You're talking about more special operations forces, more intelligence folks, logistics, artillery folks over to Syria to really press against Raqqa. That's the capital of the Islamic State, the de facto capital. And you could likely see more troops over in Iraq as well to press the city of Mosul that you just mentioned. The western part of the city, taking that is going to be much more difficult. There are narrow streets, many more people, hundreds of thousands of them there, several thousand ISIS fighters who will likely fight to the end. It's going to be a very, very tough fight.
Tom, and let's be clear, the Pentagon often uses these euphemisms about troops and supporting roles, but these guys aren't, you know, in the rear with the gear. You're talking about a potential upfront in harm's way role.
Right. Some of them will be up front and in harm's way. There's absolutely no question. Some of them will be calling in airstrikes. You'll have, again, special operations forces close to the front lines or on the front lines with either Iraqi troops or Syrian forces. But a lot of them will be away from the front lines. Again, artillery, artillerymen calling in strikes. Also, logisticians bringing in supplies, intelligence people working with drones and satellites to try to get a good picture of the battlefields. So don't think of this as the 82nd Airborne parachuting in and just taking the city of Raqqa. So again, some will be in the front lines, but not all of them, clearly.
But Tom, I have to ask, I mean, the president often says, you know, we don't win wars anymore. He seems to almost have this kind of nostalgic longing for a big decisive victory. But as we know, battling transnational terrorism isn't just a military fight, and the battle's not going to end with a signing ceremony. Is there frustration at the Pentagon that he may not understand fully the fight that they're up against or not?
I'm not sure there's frustration at the Pentagon. I think their eyes are wide open about this, and it has been for many, many years. You're right. There will be no signing on the USS Missouri like you saw at the end of World War II. These are very difficult fights. Let's say, for example, if you do have a quick and devastating blow to ISIS, what happens in Syria next? You have Assad still in power. You have the Kurdish section of the country. You have his Alawite faction. You have Sunnis in other parts of the country. What happens to Syria once the Islamic State is defeated, however many months that takes? In some respects, that's more of a difficult problem to figure out. What does that country look like in the coming years? And the same with Iraq. Once Mosul is taken, who is going to control the city? You have Kurds up there. You have some Iranian-backed forces. You have Sunnis. You have all sorts of competing entities around the city of Mosul. Who controls Mosul in the coming months? How is that going to work? And you still have the big problem in Iraq that's been a problem really from day one, the Sunni-Shia split. The Sunnis are seen as second-class citizens. They're seen as they believe they're being pressed or ignored or actually attacked by this Shia-led government. What kind of hope do you give them in the coming weeks, coming months, coming years, that they're going to be accepted as full members of Iraqi society? That's the key problem with Iraq. And again, the problem in Syria is, what does that country look like? Who's in charge and what happens in the future?
Absolutely. NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're welcome, Eric.
In June 1940, Britain's new prime minister, Winston Churchill, faced a dark reality. Hitler's war machine had smashed through Western Europe. The British Army had just made a hasty, bitter retreat home from Dunkirk, France. Great Britain was isolated and next on Hitler's attack list. On June 4, 1940, Britain's new prime minister, Winston Churchill, tried to rally the nation in a speech to the House of Commons.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
What Churchill didn't say was how dirty that fight would be and how little faith he had at that time in conventional military action. Churchill had created a top-secret organization, an eclectic group of engineers and innovators who worked around the clock to design and plan bold acts of sabotage and guerrilla warfare, to attack Hitler's supply lines and factories. Writer Giles Milton sheds light on this less well-known side of Britain's war effort in his new book, Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat. Giles Milton joins us now from London. Giles, welcome. And start with Churchill. He was a pillar of the establishment, a man seeped in conventional military thinking. How did he come to embrace unconventional warfare?
He was a pillar of the establishment, but he also, throughout his career, he'd always supported the maverick, the eccentric, the unusual. And I think in the summer of 1940, he realized that because there was no hope of tackling the Nazi war machine head on, then he needed to think of more eccentric solutions to this grave crisis that was facing the country. He began to turn to people who could dream up these creative solutions to trying to destroy or at least hit back in some small way at Hitler's army.
Let's look at some of the men who played key roles in this and who were thinking outside the box. Start with Cecil Clark, who had a mechanical engineering background.
He is one of the most extraordinary members of Churchill's inner circle. He had a highly devious brain. He was able to think outside the box in modern parlance. And he came to Churchill's attention because of the extraordinary machines he'd been building. And he was asked to try and develop a magnetic mine that could be used underwater to sink the great ships of Hitler's new fleet. And he developed this thing called the limpet mine, which could be stuck onto the underside of any of Hitler's battleships, blow up and sink the ship. And the beauty of the limpet mine, because it was a magnetic mine, was it didn't just work on ships, it worked on anything that was made of metal. So it could be used on turbines, it could be used on U-boats, anything. So it became an absolutely superb and very devious weapon of sabotage.
He was kind of this largely unknown tinkerer before this department, correct?
He was a tinkerer. He was eccentric. All his neighbors said he cut a rather comical figure when they saw him wandering around the streets, disheveled. He always looked a total mess wherever he went. But Cecil Clark had served in the First World War in an explosives battalion. And he now turned all his thoughts and all his energies into working out highly devious ways to strike back at Hitler's army.
There's a great scene in the book in the early days of this secret unit when Prime Minister Churchill invites members of the team to his country estate to demonstrate a prototype, essentially, of an anti-tank weapon. And French General Charles de Gaulle is there. Tell us how that demonstration went.
Yeah, you see, Churchill absolutely loved to have a look at these prototype weapons. He loved to see them exploding. So, yes, indeed, he invited General de Gaulle to come and watch. And, of course, Churchill absolutely detested Charles de Gaulle. Mm. And it was very funny, when they set off this new prototype missile, it almost hit de Gaulle in the head and would have blown him to pieces. And some of them were joking, some of the men there were joking that Churchill had actually bribed one of them to have a go at de Gaulle while he was there.
But actually, Churchill was quite impressed with how the prototype went.
Well, Churchill, from the very outset, was impressed with these individuals, impressed with their creativity. And he felt that with the rigid sort of military army that Hitler had constructed, there was one thing that Britain had in its favour, and that was creativity. Mm-hmm. That if you could come up with a creative solution to this enormous problem, then you had a hope of striking back, which is why he liked these colourful figures who could just dream up highly unconventional weapons, it has to be said.
There was also Colin Gubbins. He was this inventive Scotsman. Talk about what he brought to the project and to the team.
Colin Gubbins was, from a very early age, he'd been very interested in unorthodox warfare. He'd served in the trenches of the First World War, seen the horror of war in the trenches. He'd then served a very dirty war against the Bolsheviks in Russia. Mm. He'd then gone to fight against Sinn Féin in Ireland. And he'd studied all sorts of unorthodox fighters, particularly Al Capone and his Chicago gangsters. Mm. He thought the way they used their Tommy guns was absolutely brilliant. And he was brought on board to set up an organization, highly secret organization, whose exclusive goal was to explore guerrilla warfare and sabotage and how Hitler's army could best be targeted. So Colin Gubbins really was instrumental in setting up what was to become known as the Special Operations Executive. And he also brought on board this half a dozen geniuses to dream up this new ungentlemanly form of warfare.
Gubbins is essentially a pioneer in special operations, and the fact that his story is so relatively unknown today speaks to the fact, doesn't it, that the British public still kind of wrestle with the whole idea of ungentlemanly warfare.
Well, you know, in 1940, there was a debate in the House of Commons about how Britain should fight the war against Hitler. And it's extraordinary when you hear a member of parliament after member of parliament stand up and say that war it should be fought by the rule book, you know, that war was a little bit like cricket, only it used weapons. But others beg to differ, and Colin Gubbins was one of them. He said, no, when you're fighting against an enemy as devious and nasty and dangerous as the Nazis, then you simply had to tear up the rule book and anything went, basically. And that was to become his sort of creed throughout the whole of the Second World War, is that whatever the Nazis did, the British were going to fight nastier and dirtier. But of course, this was highly controversial. Many figures in the establishment, certainly in the regular army, they thought this was absolutely appalling. And so the whole idea of special operations and the various men that worked for it had to be kept completely secret throughout the duration of the war.
We're talking about creating booby traps, improvised explosive devices, using assassinations, dirty bombs. I mean, the regular British army was a bit aghast at using some of these tactics.
They were aghast. They were appalled. They tried to have the special operations, those who knew about them, tried to have them shut down. But what Churchill did is he turned one of the weapons development centres, which was to become a key centre in developing very nasty weapons of war, he converted it into an organization called MD1. It was Ministry of Defense 1, and he was Minister of Defense. It answered only to him. He financed it privately. They opened a secret bank account into which he tipped enormous amounts of money. He gave the men their own country house very near Bletchley Park, which some of your listeners may have heard of, where the Enigma code was broken. And so in this house called the Furs, a small number of highly brilliant inventors gathered and started to develop some of the most devious weapons of war ever developed.
There were some incredible missions. They helped assassinate one of Hitler's top lieutenants, Reinhard Heydrich. They blew up power plants, damaged docks, and other sabotages. What mission stands out for you?
There are two that I think are really important. The first you mentioned is the assassination of Heydrich in Prague. This was Hitler's right-hand man, his chosen favorite. The other mission was the destruction of the Norsk Hydro factory in Norway. Now, Hitler was desperate to get his hands on an atomic bomb. The only way he could do this was to use heavy water, which was produced in Norway at the Norsk Hydro factory. The British were desperate to destroy this factory. It was absolutely critical to deny Hitler an atomic bomb. They tried any number of missions. They tried to bomb it from the air. They sent commandos in. They all ended in disaster. And in desperation, Churchill turned to Colin Gubbins and said, "Over to you." Colin Gubbins trained a team of seven Norwegians, gave them bespoke weaponry, and dropped them into Norway in the depths of midwinter. And it was truly the most extraordinary sabotage operation. They climbed up this ravine, they broke into the factory, they planted their explosives, the limpet mine, incidentally, that Cecil Clarke had developed, onto the machinery of this factory. They blew it up, and then, amazingly, they got away and made it back to England. And even the man who ran the whole of German operations in Norway, when he came to inspect the damage, even he said, "This is the most extraordinary act of sabotage I've ever seen."
In reading your book, it's clear some of these missions saved lives. I mean, there's the horrific story in France where an RAF commander insisted on aerial bombing of a Nazi-held factory. They got the grid coordinates wrong, and the RAF killed hundreds of French civilians. Later on, saboteurs took out the whole factory with no civilian deaths.
This was Colin Gubbins' argument all along. He was always in conflict with Bomber Command, which simply wanted to bomb Germany into submission from the air. Colin Gubbins said this is an appalling waste of civilian lives. People were getting killed for nothing. He said it's much better to send in a small team with a bag of explosives and do these highly targeted raids, hit-and-run raids, on factories and on bridges, etc. And one of these was indeed the attack on the Peugeot factory. This was Europe's biggest industrial plant, the Peugeot car factory, which had been taken over by the Germans, and they were using it to produce tanks and armoured vehicles and planes and what have you. Colin Gubbins sent in a man called Harry Ray, a saboteur, who got together a small team of men. They went into the factory one night and they planted limpet mines and explosives on all the key items of machinery in that factory and blew it to pieces. It was, again, a consummate act of sabotage that caused unbelievable damage for the Germans.
Giles Milton's new book is Churchill's Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, The Mavericks Who Plotted Hitler's Defeat. Giles, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
It is still hard to believe it happened.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
Moonlight won. Come on, this is not a joke.
This is not a joke. I'm afraid they read the wrong thing.
This is not a joke. Moonlight has won Best Picture.
The award for Best Picture accidentally presented to the cast of La La Land instead of the actual winner, Moonlight. Presenters Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway were reportedly given the wrong envelope containing the winner for Best Actress, not Best Picture. The Best Actress was Emma Stone from La La Land. And joining us now is John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now. John, it is just unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, last year the Twitter hashtag was Oscar so white. Right. This year it's Oscar so wait, what? It was really unbelievable, kind of surreal moment. But I have to say that is it Jordan Horowitz who from La La Land, very gracious about something that had to be a knee-buckling experience for him.
Yeah, he kind of took control there. And even before Jimmy Kimmel, the host, came up to help sort out what had happened, he said, "It's Moonlight. You guys come up and accept your award." By the way, both great films, but a lot of people very happy that Moonlight was, in fact, the winner there.
Absolutely.
Now, you came in to talk to us about all of the ads that went on during the Oscars. This is still a very big night for advertisers.
It certainly is. It's known as, don't blame me for this, the Super Bowl for women. And a lot of advertisers go and make special ads for the Oscars. It's interesting. There are about $2 million per 30-second spot. And in reality, the Super Bowl is a cheaper buy. Hmm. Per viewer, you get a better value at the Super Bowl than at the Oscars. But people dropped an awful lot of money.
And some of the ads are good, and some of them you think are not so good. And let's get to one that you did not think worked. It came from Walmart, which tapped four well-known Hollywood directors to create 60-second commercials based on six products listed on the receipt. Here is Seth Rogen's project.
Scooter, 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 scooter.
Paper towels, paper towels.
What was wrong with this?
It was just a mishmash. It had six products. It worked them all in, but it was six separate little vignettes. The other ones at least had narratives. Head-scratching narratives in some cases, but they had narratives. This one was just sort of it just felt like a sort of slapdash.
One that is being talked about a lot is the one from the New York Times. They talked about the truth in their 30-second ad. Let's listen to a clip.
The truth is our nation is more divided than ever.
The truth is alternative facts are just plain delusional.
The truth is the media needs to be held accountable.
The truth is locker room talk is harmless. The truth is we need to put the safety of the...
What did you think of that one?
I thought it was really difficult to follow. And I think it's that a kind of a conference room ad. You know, people get together in the conference room and they watch it and they approve it and they don't realize people don't watch ads like that on television. I thought it tried to do too much in a 30-second spot.
Any other commercials we should talk about?
Well, I think, you know, Cadillac ran a 60-second commercial called Carry that felt very political about coming together as a country. They said, Cadillac said, it's not political or social, it's about the American spirit, but
right.
It was political or social.
Right. And yeah, I mean, a lot of people were expecting the Oscars, I guess, to be more political. It turned out that the headline from the Oscars had nothing to do with politics. It was just about the fiasco that happened at the very end. John Carroll,
exactly.
Media analyst with Here and Now and professor of mass communication at Boston University. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
The FBI is investigating whether the killing of an Indian engineer in Kansas was a hate crime. In Olathe, Kansas, last night, a vigil was held for the victim, Srinivas Kuchibotla. Witnesses say he was gunned down in an Olathe bar last Wednesday by a man yelling, "Get out of my country." Kuchibotla was legally living and working in the U.S. His best friend, Alok Madasani, was injured in the shooting. And at the vigil last night, Madasani blamed it on one individual's rage, and he praised his adopted country.
You know, it's an isolated incident that doesn't reflect the true spirit of Kansas, Midwest, and United States. Now, the United States... United States of America for us has been more about selfless people, hardworking people like Ian.
Madasani referred there to Ian Grillett, a 24-year-old Olathe resident who's being called a hero for trying to stop the gunman. Grillett was shot in the hand and chest and is recovering. He spoke from his hospital bed yesterday.
I was just doing what anyone should have done for another human being. It's not about where he's from or his ethnicity. We're all humans. So I just felt I did what was naturally right to do.
The shooting has dominated the news in India, and the Kansas chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations is calling for the Justice Department to bring federal charges in order to, quote, send a strong message that violence against minorities will not be tolerated. And we'll continue to follow that story. Today, President Trump is asking federal agencies to draw up budget plans that would increase military spending and decrease domestic spending. It's not yet clear what will be on the chopping block, but one agency that has been mentioned is the National Endowment for the Arts, which was established by Congress in 1965. Joining us now via Skype is Dana Gioia, who was the chairman of the NEA under President George W. Bush from 2003 to 2009. He's now the Poet Laureate of California. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
And let's start with the basic question. What is the NEA and what does it do?
The National Endowment for the Arts over the last half century has been the largest annual funder of the arts and arts education in the United States. In most years, the NEA gives about 2,000 grants. They go to every state, every congressional district in the United States.
And what kind of budget does it have?
Right now, it has $148 million, which has actually declined over the last 8 years. But the budget is actually misleading. The reason is that what the NEA does, and this is what the thing that most people don't understand, is it is the national catalyst for local arts and arts education. Every dollar that the NEA gives requires a match. So, you know, when it goes to the states, it goes to localities. And in the course of moving from Washington, this money actually multiplies by about seven times. So it represents about $1.2 billion of new funding. All of this money basically is invested in local economies, in local schools, museums, arts organizations. And it provides those organizations with a, as it were, a requirement to develop local support for the local programming. So it's a very powerful organization in that sense. If I can give you an example, when I became the chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, two states, Colorado and California, decided to cut their state arts budgets as a money-saving move. After some uncomfortable negotiation, I communicated to the states that if they discontinued their arts agency, by legal requirement, I could not give them funds. That compelled them to keep these organizations in operation, even though it was at a very minimal level, and it kept those services intact. So consequently, the California, which eliminated or tried to eliminate this agency, is now giving $25 million a year to the arts. It only stayed in existence because of the funds coming from the NEA.
So when you hear people talking about cutting funding for the NEA or even getting rid of the NEA altogether, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a misconception, and it's an unfortunate situation. Supporting the arts and arts education is not a partisan position. If you ask most people whether they want, you know, arts in their communities, arts in their schools, there is an overwhelmingly positive response. People have been misled to thinking that somehow there is a remote federal arts agency that is funding a few elite arts organizations. What the NEA really does is fund art programs that are actually, for the most part, created in your community by people in your community to serve your community.
Do you think that it's going to lose its funding?
I don't think so. You know, and the reason is I think most people understand the quality of the programs that are being offered. The Big Read to support, you know, literacy and reading, Shakespeare in American Community, which, you know, brings up many local theater companies to produce productions of Shakespeare's so that high school kids could actually see the plays that they're studying in school. Operation Homecoming provides workshops for the vets, you know, returning from military service and their families so they can write about their wartime experience. These are not programs that are remote from people's lives. People see immediately the value of these programs, both on a national level and a local level. So I think that what's going to happen is that we'll have to go through the same political debate, the same political arguments we did in the previous century. And ultimately, it will come down to the fact that supporting the arts and arts education is a bipartisan belief, that it's pretty much a kind of misconception that's driving the criticism. I mean, basically, the criticisms of the NEA fall into two categories. One is that the arts is just simply the government should not support. I don't think people believe that. I think, you know, people see a role for culture in their communities. And the second is a sense that somehow the NEA goes against American values, that it's promoting grants that are found offensive, you know, by people. This is really not true. The programs that the NEA supports really have almost universal public support.
What was it like to run the NEA under George W. Bush? Because it is Republicans today that want to cut the funding for it.
Running the NEA under President Bush, we were able to raise the budget every year of his presidency. Mm-hmm. We were able to build a bipartisan majority. in both houses of Congress. And, you know, we really took the agency into a period where it was, you know, well-valued and well-understood. I think one of the problems is that, you know, we were very active in those years in terms of creating a public conversation, you know, with America about what we were doing, why we were doing it, and the value. And people responded. You know, I think what's happened in some ways is that the public conversation has, first of all, diminished and secondly been monopolized by, you know, critics. I suspect that in Congress, even there, a majority of Republicans see the value of the NEA.
Now, I've heard that you are tired of having to talk about this issue.
Well, you know, I'm a poet. I'm a writer. You know, I gave a number of years of, you know, my life to public service. I was glad to be in Washington. I was glad to do good work. But I'd like to write poems now. But unfortunately, you know, I've been drafted back into this. And I think it is important. The reason I didn't really want to be NEA chairman, you know, the reason I did it is that I saw, you know, as a poet going around the United States, giving readings, giving lectures, everywhere I went, people in the audience would ask me about what they should do because they saw the arts programs being cut out of their children's schools. They saw the arts programs disappearing from their community. And this struck them quite rightly as a sort of impoverishment of their community identity, and that we needed some intelligent national leadership to rebuild the consensus about the importance of arts and arts education. Unfortunately, we need to have that conversation again.
Again and again, and we'll see where it leads this time. Dana Gioia, who was chair of the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2009 and is now a poet and the Poet Laureate of California, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here, and thank you for covering this important topic.
Now an update on a story we've been following. In Northern California, crews are shutting down the outflow from the Oroville Dam today so they can repair a badly damaged spillway. 3 weeks ago, operators found a crater in the main spillway and shut it down. But heavy rains that week caused a huge surge of water into the reservoir. And when operators let water escape through the emergency spillway, it caused dangerous erosion all along a hillside. Officials evacuated more than 180,000 people who live downstream from the dam out of safety concerns. Since then, the operators of the Oroville Dam have let more water flow out, enough to reduce the water level in the reservoir by some 60 feet. That provides a bit of a cushion in case there's more rain while the crews repair the main spillway. That's likely to take several more days. Once it's finished, operators will restart the hydroelectric power plant located at the dam. Oroville is the tallest dam in America at some 770 feet. Bluegrass music has deep roots in the rural hills of Appalachia. More than 50 years after bluegrass was made famous by the likes of Bill Monroe and Ralph Stanley, the genre is still evolving all across America. Stina Sieg of Here and Now contributor KJZZ takes us to the Phoenix suburb of Chandler to meet a new generation of bluegrass players.
Every Tuesday and Thursday afternoon, this is Annie Beach's living room. About 24 children from kindergarten to high school sit on chairs, couches, and stools, strumming guitars and bowing fiddles. A few little girls are plucking canjos, banjos made with one string and a soda can. And always there's Beach, leading the whole thing.
I can understand every single word you guys are saying. And I can't say that about a lot of professionals, so that's really good.
Miss Beach, as the kids call her, has long white braids and black, thick-rimmed glasses. The 73-year-old is tiny, far shorter than many of the kids here. But she commands a big presence. She has to. She's been running Jam Pack Blues and Grass Neighborhood Band since 1994.
We stick out. You know, we stick out in the bluegrass world especially.
That's because bluegrass is not exactly known for its diversity. But Beach's band includes kids from all backgrounds and economic situations. Everyone is welcome. No one pays anything to be here, and most of the instruments are loaned or donated. It's been that way since the very beginning, when more than 20 years ago, two little boys appeared on Beach's doorstep. She had just substituted for their second grade class, and like always, had brought along her mandolin.
And knock, knock, knock. And they said, can we play some more music?
Oh, I love those hills of old Virginia, from those blue ridge hills I did roam.
Within a short time, Beach had 17 young, eager players. Then the band kept gaining momentum and students. These days, Jam Pack plays all over Arizona, at festivals, nursing homes, and at packed concerts right in Beach's backyard. Once total outsiders, they've become this force in the Arizona bluegrass world. About 200 kids have played in the band so far, and many are second generation. Like Selena Haggerty, a 15-year-old mandolin player whose mom, aunt, and uncle were all in the band. Haggerty says she feels lucky to be here.
Yeah, I really do. I feel super, like, privileged, and I don't know, I feel like it makes me proud, like, to know that I'm here and I do this.
This is not just about making music, but about making a tight-knit community, one that very few players ever really leave, even when they grow up. Tons of Jam Pack alums stick around, maybe teaching the younger kids or spinning off into new bands. 13-year-old Alazia Zuwaldi, who plays an old-time stringed instrument called the mountain dulcimer, describes the Jam Pack culture like this.
It's coming together to play music and becoming one despite anything, despite, you know, the differences that we all have. We all come together to form this beautiful thing.
And is there a secret to creating that beauty? Annie Beach smiles and sighs.
Oh, boy. There's a great deal of love goes into it. Even if I get mad, anything, I love every single person that's part of this.
Miss Beach hopes someday one of those people will take up the responsibility of Jam Pack, keep it going long after she's gone. Right now, she's the one who drives many of the kids to and from practice, who cooks them dinner every night they're here. She makes them all photo albums and hosts birthday parties. It's a lot of work, she says, but it's no sacrifice. It's how she wants to spend the rest of her life.
And I say I want a pure heart and I want a pure focus from here until you guys are singing me out.
For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.